Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode, we have my hero. I think a man who is a hero to many, Daniel Sexton Gurney. We're in the middle of what I refer to as American motor racing's golden week. That incredible period from 1967, where Dan Gurney and AJ Foyt, Ford Motor Company, won the 24 Hours of Le Mans in a Ford GT40. Dan then moved from France, drove across to Belgium, and won the Spa race, the Spa Formula One Grand Prix, in his All-American Racers Westlake V12-powered Formula One machine. I think, as we, most of us know, the first and only owner, driver, winner, and a creation came from his hands and the other members of the AAR team. This golden week, though, here we are at 50 years, 50-year anniversary of the golden week. Just having some time with a big eagle, a blessing, a true blessing. Spent about 30 minutes on the phone with Dan, maybe 40 or so. He is, his memory is amazing. He can remember more than I can, which is embarrassing, but that's why he's Dan Gurney, and I'm not. Nonetheless, with this golden week here, it's something, honestly, every year we celebrate just because it's happened once. It will never happen again. This was us, at our finest, going to Europe, taking on the best in endurance racing, knocking Ferrari and others off their perch, and then heading over to Spa and doing the same there. Never happen again. And with Dan, who is the architect of the latter accomplishment and a huge, huge part of the first accomplishment, just a treasure to be able to recount this with him. As you'll hear, you know, he's spoken about this so many times that I think he's just about worn out. And as I said to him, are you happy you're getting to the finish line there? And by finish line, I meant with the 50th anniversary. Hopefully, you know, folks won't bother him as much at the 51st, 52nd. So anyways, just some time with Dan, talking about these two races, these two wins, what it did for him, maybe how his life would have changed if he hadn't have won, one or both. Just, again, sitting at the feet of legends and heroes, easily the best part of what I do, bar none, no question. Talking with Dan about these accomplishments, easily the highlight of my year so far. All right, you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes when it comes out. We also post those immediately to our Facebook page, Marshall Pruitt Podcast. With all that done, off we go with the big eagle, Daniel Sexton Gurney.
Dan Gurney calling. How are you, sir?
Well,
you know, as long as there's a little bit of pink on the inside, you'll be okay.
So what do you want to talk about?
I seem to recall there was a pretty cool thing that happened about 50 years ago in France, and then you did it again in Belgium. I don't know if anyone's ever mentioned that to you before.
Only everybody. No problem at all. I'm not complaining about it.
The one thing Robin and I were talking about yesterday, and I don't know if there's anything to this or not, but we were both wondering, what would Dan's life be like without that Le Mans win, without that Spa win? Because at least from everything we've read and recall, it seems like this time 50 years ago really propelled you to much greater level of interest and stardom and, you know, all the accoutrement that go with success. But have you ever thought about that? You know, what if these things hadn't happened, and if and how that would have maybe changed your life?
Well, two things. I probably would have kept going to Le Mans.
Hmm.
Just because of what it was, the history of it all. And then with Spa, I probably would have been shut down financially.
The part that I love that you mentioned is about Le Mans. I mean, was AJ mentioned that, you know, winning his first time there definitely quenched any desire that there might have been to keep going back. You had obviously tried multiple times to win Le Mans. Was there that sense of satisfaction, like, okay, we won it. Maybe I don't need to keep risking life and limb to go back and get number two?
Would I like to do number two? No. that was it, and we also set new records and did it with Americans and American cars, so that kind of seemed like we had reached the pinnacle. There's a lot of stuff I could say, in fact, even a compliment from Shelby.
Yeah?
That car was under Shelby's part of the Ford program, though basically Firestone and Goodyear, Shelby with Goodyear, and Bowman and Moody, and those guys were Firestone. And Ford leaned a little bit towards Firestone because of Henry Ford's relationship with Harvey Firestone.
Sure.
After looking at the reasons why we hadn't done better in the past, because we were always up front, or within, I think I went there in 58, and I was going very well with Bruce Kessler. Anyway, Evie gets mad when I keep mentioning Cunningham, so I won't do that, but basically, I looked at the, who I admired a lot, you know, he went there with American Cars and, among others, John Fitch, but Phil Walters was my, a guy that I liked a great deal. I saw him racing midgets as Ted Tappet, and I just learned a lot from him just watching.
Wow.
Because in those days, you're watching midgets, you can almost put yourself in the seat and you can see what the traffic situations are and how to go about doing it. And he had the ability to work his way through traffic in a way that didn't bother other people. And it was just an amazing display of great judgment and skill.
I never would have thought of that, Dan. I really would. That to me is so brilliant. I would never would have thought of. I mean, granted, it's racing is racing, I guess, but, you know, most folks would think that you spent hours, you know, surveying drivers at Riverside or some other road course, and, you know, the fact that you can glean these things from, you know, a midget driver in midget racing and apply it to Le Mans or wherever.
That was at Freeport Stadium in Long Island. It was just a very popular time at that time, probably 1947 or so. 48, maybe. I also had decided I wanted to go to Indy to observe it in 1948, and I ended up breaking my rear end and transmission during the snowstorm, and I never got there.
Mm.
12 years later, I got there, but not...
Well, I was going to say, you're trying to use your use the new midget knowledge in the snow and rain maybe on the way there. And, you know, I don't know if you found the cushion. But one of the things, Dan, which I know folks have tried to make something about you and AJ and being misfitting at Le Mans, I have come to appreciate the opposite. AJ has a reputation for being a bit cranky and a few other things, but it was really heartwarming to see the two of you together at Long Beach, for example. Just the amount of care and respect and warmth that not only the two of you had for each other, but that you had for him. It seemed to me that, you know, 50 years later, someone who you had this amazing win with at Le Mans, time could pull you apart, time could stray relationships, but instead, someone who maybe doesn't have a ton of lifelong friendship definitely has one with you.
I do appreciate it, even though when I could, I was a competitor, so I got a chance to watch AJ and to learn from him and run against him, actually got ahead of him a few times, and but mostly as a racing fan, the era when AJ was on top and Mario was fighting his way in there probably has never been exceeded in terms of interest, and nobody knew much about cars compared to what they do now.
Yeah.
And it was an intense kind of learning or attempting to learn. And there was Steve Siglitz, and there were, you know, they wouldn't tell a competitor the time of day.
Mm.
So it was a great thing to be in and to be part of. I think AJ was braggadocio. Yes, we used to call him Cassius. And,
That is so perfect.
Yeah, well, that's right. In both cases, they were, they could back it up.
Yeah, you cross him, you will get stung like a bee. I can see that for sure.
At that time, it 24-hour endurance contest.
Mm.
And there's a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
I never drove one lap within about 3 to 4 seconds of what I could have. Never. In practice, yeah. In qualifying, and in the race. The same program. Because the Achilles heel of that car were the brakes. I guess that's Achilles heels. Anyway, so I was the main, at least my theory was, the main damage to the brakes would occur if you're going 212 or 13, which was about what it would run.
Yeah.
And then you went down and deep into the turn at the end of the Mulsanne straight and put the brakes on, you know, you'd kill it. Kill the brakes.
You're doing an unholy amount of speed every lap.
Well, my scheme, put it, was to, at the end of the Mulsanne straight, I was backing off about 250 yards before I needed to, and letting it coast down on the engine. So then instead of slowing down from 212 or 13, I was slowing down from maybe 170, 165.
Yeah.
And the difference was much better for the brakes. The fact that you didn't show your hands during practice, during qualifying, or during the race had a lot to do with how the car finished.
Well, I've just appreciated the heavy layer of intelligence that was applied from within the cockpit. And to your point, there are a lot of fast drivers in that race, and there are a lot of fast cars. And at this stage in this era, the biggest mistake you could make is trying to prove to the world how fast you were at the expense of the machinery and lasting all 24 hours instead of just part of 24 hours. So not a surprise that the Gurney and Foyt car is the one that Dunn made it to the finish as something other than a steaming pile.
I just thought I was going to take it as an endurance contest and do it that way for the whole thing from the beginning to the end. And that's what we did. I set a mark that AJ equaled very easily, and we didn't pay attention to what the competition was doing.
Mm.
From the other Ford, the Firestone side of things,
yeah,
and the Ferraris and so forth. So in the race, I was really surprised that we were leading so early. I think it was just after an hour into the race, I was in the lead, and I hadn't changed anything in terms of how to do it.
Yeah.
That took care of what might have been a who could drive the fastest contest.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't not as important as trying to win a race. So,
yeah. The who can win contest took priority over the who can go fastest priority.
I think that today, at least listening to what the drivers and the crews say, they're running every lap as fast as they can.
Yeah.
And that's different. We couldn't do that in those. It's amazing that they have developed the brakes and so forth enough to withstand that. Jerry Grant and I in 66 led the race a lot, but it was, and we didn't hurt the thing brake-wise, but I think we had a blown head gasket.
Mm.
That was just the luck of the draw, I think. It was still, that's reality.
You know, one thing, Dan, which I'm curious about, we have with today's Ford team that's going to Le Mans hoping to win. They obviously won last year, hoping to win again this year. It was great speaking with Joey Hand, for example, Californian kid, won last year for them. Speak to some of the other, you know, there aren't a bunch of Americans on the Le Mans team, but there are a couple. And they just speak, even though, you know, your win and AJ's win happened before they were born, they still speak with great reverie for what you achieved, knowing that, you know, you set the standard, and that team set the standard, and they're just wanting to live up, you know, at least hope to be considered worthy of being in your shadow. Do you have an appreciation for, you know, this new generation trying to, if anything, make you and AJ and the rest of the team proud 50 years later?
Well, I understand that completely, and I commend them for having that kind of spirit. And the race itself has maintained its global reputation So if they have an opportunity, even if it's got a lot of negatives to it, why, they still get out there and do it, and I know that they feel good by being able to be there and do the best they can, regardless of whether they have handicaps or not. Racing is possibly becoming obsolete these days. Sure, a lot of people that keep showing up. I don't know what the stepping stones to becoming a race driver are anymore. It was certainly overwhelming in those days that that's what we wanted to do, and maybe even silly, but we were deadly serious about it all, and the history of the automobile and so forth was very important to us. And if you could get a page in that book, that seemed to be terrific.
So Sunday is the 50th anniversary of your Spaw win. People have probably asked you this before, and I doubt I've arrived at anything new, but it definitely seems like there's parallels between your Le Mans success in terms of realizing that it was a race of endurance. You had to take care of the car and be mechanically sympathetic. Looking at the, I was rereading the Spaw race report and competition press last night, and it just seemed that between Jimmy Clark's issues, the fuel starvation issues you had, Jackie Stewart with a gearbox issue, even though we're talking Formula One and essentially a sprint race, it still seemed like if you were going to succeed, you could not be a complete animal behind the wheel. Was there any similarity in terms of mentality or approach between being in a Ford GT or being in your own Formula One car in terms of, all right, don't beat this thing up too much?
We, back then, we had more awareness of the limits of RPM and valve technology, and that seemed to be, in various engines, ran fine up to that limit. That sort of set the stage for how you had to approach it, and you had to drive within the bounds of that those limits, and that took a good sense of feeling for it, and also a strict attention being paid to things like the rev limiter. And my impression today is that all the various aspects of today's engines have sort of evolved into where they can withstand a pretty abusive use.
Yeah.
And they seem to be all right. I mean, they've got the, you can run past the peak power and into the high revs in a way that you couldn't have done in those days. And they seem to be able to, while the, metallurgy and lubrication and all kinds of temperature involved things seem to be much more tolerant, so you can climb in and just go racing.
You know, one of the things I wondered about, Dan, this is maybe more just a camaraderie question, but knowing that Formula One in this era, 1967, so many amazing drivers, but the finishing record at each round was, you could say, highly suspect. You know, it could be a gearbox, it could be a spark plug, it could be a you name it. Was there any kind of, commiserating club after the race where, you and Clark and Holm and whomever, just shared, all right, what took you out or what did you have to persevere through? Because when I look at the Spa result, it definitely seems like, very few people that made it to the finish line, yourself included, did every single lap with no issues. It seemed like everybody was having to nurse something or be extra careful with something to get to the finish line.
Yeah, that's probably true, but when Cosworth got there, I like to call it the Ford Cosworth, but anyway, it had certain weaknesses that were pretty rapidly sealed up. That meant that they had a very strong ability to win races. And had we really, with our Gurney was like 12-cylinder, it didn't have any real mechanical limits. It was darn good from that standpoint, but it we never did get it where it was scavenging properly. So it used to slow down as it as you kept racing. And after on the third lap, it was a bit slower. It was like a washing machine full of, in this case, full of oil. And Michael Daniels was the guy running Westlake. That was Harry Westlake's son-in-law. Michael is a great guy. He's still around, and he tackled that thing and did a terrific job with a relatively small group of people. I mean, super small.
Wow.
And probably more like half a dozen. That naturally, evolution can be, if you have a wartime budget, you can evolve a lot more rapidly, but we didn't have that. We had to make the best of what we had, and I thought the guy that Westlake did a terrific job, and it was a reliable engine. Had we solved one or two other problems, it would have been fun to find out what would happen.
You know, we last question or two for you, sir. So a couple years ago, we spoke for a Road and Track article about the magic of Eau Rouge and what it took to get through there quickly and safely and, you know, to retain your physical health as well. And you shared some wonderful insights. And I was just looking at some photos from the 67 race last night. And granted, the photo could have been taken during practice, so I can't say exactly. But one thing I was surprised to see at Eau Rouge were photographers, I don't know, maybe a foot off of the edge of the track. So, I mean, we've seen plenty of these photos, you know, back in the day. This wasn't a strange thing to see photographers up close to the edge of a track. It just surprised me that someone would be crazy enough to do that at Eau Rouge. Do you recall having any thoughts about, are these silly bastards expecting me to apex off their foot? Or, I mean, good Lord, man, take a step back. I don't know if you thought that or saw that and thought it was weird, but at that corner at least, I don't know. It seems like there's some folks just willfully flirting with danger.
I've seen the photographs, and it is amazing. They were brave. I don't know about their judgment, but it turned out well. I remember when we had the first race in the Long Beach era, I was in charge of telling the photographers where they could go and where they couldn't. I had a meeting with all the photographers, and I said, you can go anywhere you want to go. So they loved that, and nobody got hurt, and they got a lot of good photographs. So it wasn't until the bureaucrats got hold of everything that they couldn't go to places anymore.
Well, I enjoy signing the 17 waivers and everything else every time I have to go. Now that we're on the 50-year anniversary of this golden week of achievements for you, having won Le Mans a Sunday and then won Spa the following Sunday, is there any sense of appreciation just for the fact that this continues to stand now 50 years later is just a week of amazing achievements for the home team, for the USA and international motor racing?
It says a lot of things. It's wonderful to have a little spot of history, and there was appreciation for that era. You know, the almost insane desire to give it all in the racing without much remuneration is still there. It's been interesting if you really, really aware of history and of the evolution of traveling and of the global thing of Formula One back in those days, and all the have everything transported there and ready to go and all that. I think it was very, very special. So we were, of course, we wanted to win, but in the process, we had to learn a lot of excuses. On the thing with AJ, we agreed to philosophy of how we're going to approach that race, and AJ did a great job. Cassius and Dan agreed on the plan.
That needs to be a t-shirt immediately. Well, as always, sir, I greatly appreciate your time. And once I get done with a little bit of travel here on my end, as I told Kath, hoping to come down and just spend a little bit of time in person. And
yeah, please do. We've got some great things going. The boys are doing some wonderful things here.
And that was the Big Eagle. Just such a pleasure to spend time with Dan. There's also something really cool, incredibly cool, going on in Los Angeles right now. It's a Gurney exhibit at the Peterson Museum. Just a palatial, just, if you know about it, then I don't need to say a word. If you don't, please look it up. It is an American gem, like Dan himself. And I'm actually going to be heading down there July 8th to help do a Coffee with Curators talk and tour. We're just going to walk around and try to impart a little bit of love and insight and share some of what makes Dan, All-American Racers, the great Phil Remington, Len Terry, to just dozens if not hundreds of people that have passed through those halls that have made them an American institution that hopefully will continue to be honored by the good folks at Peterson and at other museums and other installations any and everywhere else. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thank you for listening.